like a mantra.
8. New York City. That same evening, the other universe inhabited by Gabriel Allon was also on edge, but for decidedly different reasons. It was the fall auction season in New York, the anxious time when the art world in all its folly and excess convenes for 2 weeks of frenzied buying and selling. It was, as Nicholas Lovegrove liked to say, one of the few remaining occasions when it was still considered fashionable to be vastly rich. It was also, however, a deadly serious business. Great collections would be built, great fortunes made and lost. A single transaction could launch a brilliant career. It could also destroy one. Lovegrove's professional reputation, like Gabriel Allon's, was by that evening firmly established. British-born and educated, he was regarded as the most sought-after art consultant in the world. A man so powerful he could move markets with an offhand remark or a wrinkle of his elegant nose. His knowledge of art was legendary, as was the size of his bank account. Lovegrove no longer had to troll for clients. They came to him, usually on bended knee and with promises of vast commissions. The secret of Lovegrove's success lay in his unfailing eye and in his discretion. Lovegrove never betrayed a confidence. Lovegrove never gossiped or engaged in double-dealing. He was the rarest of birds in the art trade, a man of his word. His reputation notwithstanding, Lovegrove was beset by his usual case of pre-auction jitters as he hurried along Sixth Avenue. After years of falling prices and anemic sales, the art market was at last beginning to show signs of renewal. The season's first auctions had been respectable, but had fallen short of expectations. Tonight's sale, the post-war and contemporary at Christie's, had the potential to set the art world ablaze. As usual, Lovegrove had clients at both ends of the auction. Two were sellers, vendors, in the lexicon of the trade, while a third was looking to acquire Lot 12, Ochre and Red on Red, Oil on Canvas, by Mark Rothko. The client in question was unique in that Lovegrove did not know his name. He dealt only with a certain Mr. Hamdali in Paris, who in turn dealt with the client. The arrangement was unorthodox, but from Lovegrove's perspective, highly lucrative. During the past 12 months alone, the collector had acquired more than $200 million worth of paintings. Lovegrove's commissions on those sales were in excess of $20 million. If things went according to plan tonight, his net worth would rise substantially. He rounded the corner onto West 49th Street and walked a half block to the entrance of Christie's. The soaring glass-walled lobby was a sea of diamonds, silk, ego, and collagen. Lovegrove paused briefly to kiss the perfumed cheek of a German packaging heiress before making his way to the coat check line, where he was promptly set upon by a pair of secondary dealers from the Upper East Side. He put them off with a defensive movement of his hand, then collected his bidding paddle and headed upstairs to the salesroom. For all its intrigue and glamour, it was a surprisingly ordinary room, a cross between the United Nations General Assembly Hall and the church of a television evangelist. The walls were a drab shade of grey-beige, as were the folding chairs, which were smashed tightly together to maximise the limited space. Behind the pulpit-like rostrum was a revolving display case, and next to the case, a bank of telephones staffed by a half-dozen Christie's employees. Lovegrove glanced up at the sky suites, hoping to glimpse a face or two behind the tinted glass, then turned warily toward the reporters penned like cattle in the back corner. Concealing his paddle number, he hurried past them and headed to his usual seat at the front of the room. It was the promised land, the place where all dealers, consultants, and collectors hoped one day to sit. It was not a spot for the faint of heart, or the short of cash. Lovegrove referred to it as the kill zone. The auction was scheduled to begin at 6. Francis Hunt, Christie's chief auctioneer, granted his fidgety audience 5 additional minutes to find their seats before taking his place. He had polished manners and a droll English urbanity that, for some inexplicable reason, still made Americans feel inferior. In his right hand was the famous Black Book that held the secrets of the universe, at least as far as this evening was concerned. Each lot in the sale had its own page containing information such as the seller's reserve, a seating chart showing the location of expected bidders, and Hunt's strategy for extracting the highest possible price. Lovegrove's name appeared on the page devoted to Lot 12, the Rothko. During a private pre-sale viewing, Lovegrove had hinted he might be interested, but only if the price was right and the stars were in proper alignment. Hunt knew Lovegrove was lying, of course. Hunt knew everything. He wished the audience a pleasant evening, then, with all the fanfare of a maitre d' summoning a party of four, said, "Lot one, the Twombly." The bidding commenced immediately, moving swiftly upward in $100,000 increments. The auctioneer deftly managed the process with the help of two immaculately coiffed spotters who strutted and posed behind the rostrum like a pair of male models at a photo shoot. Lovegrove might have been impressed with the performance had he not known it was all carefully choreographed and rehearsed in advance. At 1,000,005, the bidding stalled, only to be revived by a telephone bid for 1,000,006. Five more bids followed in quick succession, at which point the bidding paused for a second time. "The bid is 2.1 million, with Cordelia on the telephone," Hunt intoned, eyes moving seductively from bidder to bidder. "It's not with you, madam, nor with you, sir. 2.1, on the telephone, for the Twombly. Fair warning now. Last chance." Down came the gavel with a sharp crack. "Thank you," murmured Hunt as he recorded the transaction in his black book. After the Twombly, it was the Liechtenstein, followed by the Basquiat, the Diebenkorner, the de Kooning, the Johns, the Pollock, and a parade of Warhols. Each work fetched more than the pre-sale estimate, and more than the previous lot. It was no accident. Hunt had cleverly stacked the deck to create an ascending scale of excitement. By the time Lot 12 slid onto the display case, he had the audience and the bidders exactly where he wanted them. "On my right we have the Rothko," he announced. "Shall we start the bidding at 12 million? It was 2 million above the pre-sale estimate, a signal that Hunt expected the work to go big. Lovegrove drew a mobile phone from the breast pocket of his Brioni suit jacket and dialed a number in Paris. Hamdali answered. He had a voice like warm tea sweetened with honey. "My client would like to get a sense of the room before making a first bid." "Wise move." Lovegrove placed the phone on his lap and folded his hands. It quickly became apparent they were in for a tough fight. Bids flew at Hunt from all corners of the room, and from Christie's staff manning the telephones. Hector Candiotti, art advisor to a Belgian industrial magnate, was holding his paddle in the air like a crossing guard, a blusterous bidding technique known as steamrolling. Tony Berenger, who worked for a Russian aluminum oligarch, was bidding as though his life depended on it, which was not beyond the realm of possibility. Lovegrove waited until the price reached 30 million before picking up the phone again. "Well?" he asked calmly.
"Not yet, Mr. Lovegrove."
This time Lovegrove kept the phone pressed to his ear. In Paris, Hamdali was speaking to someone in Arabic. Unfortunately, it was not one of the several languages Lovegrove spoke fluently. Biding his time, he surveyed the sky suites, searching for secret bidders. In one, he noticed a beautiful young woman holding a mobile phone. After a few seconds, Lovegrove noticed something else. When Hamdali was speaking, the woman was sitting silently. And when the woman was speaking, Hamdali was saying nothing. It was probably a coincidence, he thought, but then again, maybe not. "Perhaps it's time to test the waters," suggested Lovegrove, his eyes on the woman in the skybox.
"Perhaps you're right," answered Hamdali. "One moment, please."
Hamdali murmured a few words in Arabic. A few seconds later, the woman in the skybox spoke into her mobile phone. Then in English, Hamdali said,
"The client agrees, Mr. Lovegrove. Please make your first bid."
The current bid was 34 million. With the arch of a single eyebrow, Lovegrove raised it by another million.
"We have 35, said Hunt, in a tone that indicated a serious new predator had entered the fray.
Hector Candiotti immediately countered, as did Tony Berenger. A pair of sparring telephone bidders pushed the price across the $40 million threshold, then Jack Chambers, the real estate king, casually bid 41. Lovegrove wasn't terribly worried about Jack. The affair with that little tart in New Jersey had cost him dearly in the divorce. Jack wasn't liquid enough to go the distance.
"The bid is 41 against you," Lovegrove murmured into the telephone. "The client believes there is a great deal of posturing going on. It's an art auction at Christie's. Posturing is de rigueur."
"Patience, Mr. Lovegrove."
Lovegrove kept his eyes on the woman in the skybox as the bidding cracked the $50 million threshold. Jack Chambers made a final bid at 60. Tony Berenger and his Russian gangster did the honours at 70. Hector Candiotti responded by waving the white flag. "It looks like it's down to us and the Russian," Lovegrove said to the man in Paris. "My client doesn't care for Russians." "What would your client like to do about it?" "What is Rothko's record at auction?"
72 and change.
"Please bid 75.
"It's too much.
"You'll never place the bid, Mr. Lovegrove." Lovegrove arched an eyebrow and raised five fingers. "The bid is 75 million, said Hunt. "It's not with you, sir, nor with you. 75 million for the Rothko. Fair warning now. Last chance. All done?"
Crack.
A gasp rose in the room. Lovegrove looked up at the skybox, but the woman was gone. 9. The Lizard Peninsula, Cornwall. With the approval of Scotland Yard, the Home Office, and the British Prime Minister himself, Gabriel and Chiara returned to Cornwall 3 days after the bombing in Covent Garden. Madonna and child, with Mary Magdalene, oil on canvas, 110 by 92 centimetres, arrived at 10 the following morning. After carefully removing the painting from its protective coffin, Gabriel placed it on an antique oak easel in the living room and spent the remainder of the afternoon studying the X-rays. The ghostly images only strengthened his opinion that the painting was indeed a Titian, and a very good Titian at that. It had been several months since Gabriel had laid hands on a painting, and he was anxious to begin work right away. Rising early the following morning, he prepared a bowl of café au lait and immediately threw himself into the delicate task of relining the canvas. The first step involved adhering tissue paper over the image to avoid further paint losses during the procedure. There were a number of over-the-counter glues suitable for the task, but Gabriel always preferred to mix his own adhesive using the recipe he learned in Venice from the master restorer Umberto Conti. Pellets of rabbit-skin glue dissolved in a mixture of water, vinegar, ox bile, and molasses. He simmered the noxious-smelling concoction on the kitchen stove until it was the consistency of syrup, and watched the morning news on the BBC while waiting for the mixture to cool. Farid Khan was now a household name in the United Kingdom. Given the precise timing of his attack, Scotland Yard and British intelligence were operating under the assumption it was linked to the bombings in Paris and Copenhagen. Still unclear was the terrorist affiliation of the bombers. Debate among the television experts was intense, with one camp proclaiming the attacks were orchestrated by Al-Qaeda's old-line leadership in Pakistan, and another declaring that they were clearly the work of a new network that had yet to produce a blip on the radar screens of Western intelligence. Whatever the case, European authorities were bracing for more bloodshed. MI5's Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre had raised the threat level to critical, meaning another attack was expected imminently. Gabriel focused most intently on a report dealing with questions over Scotland Yard's conduct in the minutes before the attack. In a carefully worded statement, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police acknowledged receiving a warning about a suspicious man in an oversized coat headed toward Covent Garden. "Regrettably," said the Commissioner, "the tip did not rise to the level of specificity required for lethal action." He then confirmed that two SO-19 officers had been dispatched to Covent Garden, but said they had no choice under existing policy but to hold their fire. As for reports of a weapon being drawn, police had questioned the man involved and determined it was not a gun but a camera. For reasons of privacy, the man's identity would not be revealed. The press appeared to accept the Met's version of events, as did the civil libertarians, who applauded the restraint shown by the police even if it had meant the loss of 18 innocent lives. Gabriel switched off the television as Chiara entered the kitchen. She immediately opened a window to drive out the stench of the ox bile and vinegar, and berated Gabriel for fouling her favourite stainless steel saucepan. Gabriel only smiled and dipped the tip of his forefinger into the mixture. It was now cool enough to use. With Chiara peering over his shoulder, he applied the glue evenly over the yellowed varnish and adhered several rectangles of tissue paper to the surface. Titian's handiwork was now invisible, and would remain so for the next several days, until the relining was complete.
Gabriel could do no more work that morning except to check on the painting periodically to make certain the glue was drying properly. He sat in the covered gazebo overlooking the sea, a notebook computer on his lap, and scoured the internet for more information about the three bombings. He was tempted to check in with King Saul Boulevard, but thought better of it. He had neglected to inform Tel Aviv of his brush with terror in Covent Garden, and to do so now would only give his former colleagues an excuse to intrude on his life. Gabriel had learned from experience it was best to treat the office like a jilted lover. Contact had to be kept to a minimum, and was best conducted in public places where a messy scene would be inappropriate. Shortly before noon, the last remnants of a midnight gale passed over Gunwallow Cove, leaving in its wake a clear sky of crystalline blue. After making one final check of the painting, Gabriel pulled on an anorak and a pair of hiking boots and headed out for his daily march along the cliffs. The previous afternoon, he had trooped north along the coastal path to Praa Sands. Now he mounted the small rise behind the cottage and headed south toward Lizard Point. It did not take long for the magic of the Cornish coast to chase away the memories of the dead and wounded in Covent Garden. Indeed, by the time Gabriel had reached the fringes of Mullion Golf Club, the last terrible image was safely concealed beneath a layer of obliterating paint. As he pressed farther south, past the rocky outcropping of the Polurian cliffs, he thought only of the work to be done on the Titian. Tomorrow he would carefully remove the painting from its stretcher, and then adhere the weakened canvas to a swath of fresh Italian linen, pressing it firmly into place with a heavy tailoring iron. Next came the longest and most arduous phase of the restoration, removing the cracked and yellowed varnish and retouching those portions of the painting lost to time and stress. While some restorers tended to be aggressive in their retouching, Gabriel was known throughout the art world for the lightness of his touch, and his uncanny ability to mimic the brush strokes of the old masters. He believed it was the duty of a restorer to come and go without being seen, leaving no evidence of his presence other than a painting returned to its original glory. By the time Gabriel reached the northern end of Kynan's Cove, a line of dark clouds had obscured the sun, and the sea wind had turned markedly colder. A keen observer of Cornwall's capricious weather, he could see that the bright interval, as British meteorologists like to call periods of sunshine, was about to come to an abrupt end. He paused for a moment, debating where to take shelter. To the east, across a patchwork quilt landscape, was Lizard Village. Directly ahead was the point. Gabriel chose the second option. He didn't want to shorten his walk over something as trivial as a passing squall. Besides, there was a good cafe atop the cliffs where he could wait out the storm over a freshly baked scone and a pot of tea. He turned up the collar of his anorak and headed along the rim of the cove as the first rain began to fall. The cafe appeared, veiled in mist. At the base of the cliffs, sheltering against the leeward side of the derelict boathouse, was a man in his mid-twenties with short hair and sunglasses propped on his head. A second man was loitering atop the observation point, his eye pressed to a coin-operated telescope. Gabriel knew with certainty it had been inoperative for months. He slowed to a stop and looked toward the cafe just as a third man stepped onto the terrace. He wore a waterproof hat pulled close to his brow, and a pair of rimless eyeglasses favoured by German intellectuals and Swiss bankers. His expression was one of impatience, a busy executive who had been forced by his wife to take a holiday. He stared directly at Gabriel for a long moment, before lifting his thick wrist toward his face and consulting his watch. Gabriel was tempted to turn in the opposite direction. Instead, he lowered his gaze to the footpath and walked on. Better to do it in public, he thought. It would reduce the chances of a messy scene. 10. Lizard Point, Cornwall.
"Did you really have to order scones?" asked Uzi Navot, resentfully.
"They're the best in Cornwall. So is the clotted cream."
Navot made no movement. Gabriel gave a perceptive smile.
"How much more weight does Bella want you to lose?"
5 pounds. Then I get to go on maintenance," Navot added gloomily, as though it were a prison sentence. "What I wouldn't give for your metabolism. You're married to one of the world's greatest cooks, but you still have the body of a 25-year-old. Me? I'm married to one of the country's foremost experts on Syria, and if I even smell a pastry, I have to let my trousers out. Maybe it's time you told Bella to lighten up on the dietary restrictions. You tell her, Navot said. All those years studying the Baathists in Damascus have left a mark on her. Sometimes I feel as though I'm living in a police state.
They were seated at an isolated table near the rain-spattered windows. Gabriel was facing the interior, Navot the sea. He was wearing a pair of corduroy trousers and a beige sweater that still smelled of the men's department at Harrods. He placed his cap on an adjacent chair and ran a hand over his cropped, strawberry-blonde hair. It had a bit more grey in it than Gabriel remembered, but that was understandable. Uzi Navot was now the chief of Israel's secret intelligence service. Grey hair was one of the many fringe benefits of the job. Were Navot's brief tenure to end now, it would almost certainly be regarded as among the most successful directorships in the long and storied history of the office. The accolades that had been bestowed upon him were a result of Operation Masterpiece, the joint Anglo-American-Israeli undertaking that had resulted in the destruction of 4 secret Iranian nuclear facilities. Much of the credit rightly belonged to Gabriel, though Navot preferred not to dwell on that aspect of the affair. He had been awarded the job as chief only because Gabriel had repeatedly turned it down, and the 4 enrichment facilities would still be spinning away if Gabriel hadn't identified and recruited the Swiss businessman who was covertly selling component parts to the Iranians. For the moment, however, Navot's thoughts seemed focused only on the plate of scones. Unable to resist any longer, he selected one, split it with great care, and smothered it with strawberry preserves and a dollop of the clotted cream. Gabriel poured himself a cup of tea from an aluminum pot and quietly asked about the purpose of Navot's unannounced visit. He did so in fluent German, which he spoke with a Berlin accent of his mother. It was one of 5 languages he and Navot had in common.
I had a number of housekeeping issues to discuss with my British counterparts. Included on the agenda was a somewhat perplexing report about one of our former agents who's now living in retirement here under MI5 protection. There was a wild rumour going around about this agent and the bombing in Covent Garden. To be honest, I was a bit dubious when I heard it. Knowing this agent well, I couldn't imagine that he would endanger his position in Britain by doing something so foolish as drawing his weapon in public. What should I have done, Uzi? You should have called your MI5 minder and washed your hands of it. And if you had found yourself in a similar position? If I were in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, I wouldn't have hesitated to put the bastard down. But here... Navot's voice trailed off. I suppose I would have considered the potential consequences of my actions first. 18 people died, Uzi. Consider yourself lucky the death toll wasn't 19. Navot removed his spindly eyeglasses, something he often did before embarking on an unpleasant conversation. I'm tempted to ask whether you actually intended to take the shot. But given your training and your past exploits, I'm afraid I know the answer. An office agent draws his weapon in the field for one reason and one reason only. He doesn't wave it around like a gangster or make idle threats. He pulls the trigger and shoots to kill. Navot paused, then added, Do unto others before they have a chance to do unto you. I believe those words can be found on page 12 of Chevron's little red book. He knows about Covent Garden? You know better than to ask a question like that. Chevron knows everything. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he heard about your little adventure before I did. Despite my attempts to ease him into permanent retirement, he insists on staying in contact with his sources from the old days.
Gabriel added a few drops of milk to his tea and stirred it slowly. Chevron. The name was nearly synonymous with the history of Israel and its intelligence services. After fighting in the war that led to Israel's reconstitution, Ari Chevron had spent the subsequent 60 years protecting the country from a host of enemies bent on its destruction. He had penetrated the courts of kings, stolen the secrets of tyrants, and killed countless foes, sometimes with his own hands, sometimes with the hands of men such as Gabriel. Only one secret had eluded Chevron. The secret of contentment. Aged now and in dreadful health,
He clung desperately to his role as the eminence grise of Israel's security establishment, and still meddled in the internal affairs of the office as though it were his private fiefdom. It was not arrogance that drove Shamron, but a nagging fear that his entire life's work had been in vain. Though economically prosperous and militarily strong, Israel remained surrounded by a world that was, for the most part, hostile to its very existence. The fact that Gabriel had chosen to reside in this world was among Shamron's greatest disappointments. "I'm surprised he didn't come here himself," Gabriel said. "He was tempted." "Why didn't he?"
"It's not so easy for him to travel."
"What's wrong now?"
"Everything,"
Navot said, shrugging his heavy shoulders.
"He rarely leaves Tiberias these days. He just sits on his terrace, staring out at the lake. He's driving Gila to distraction. She's been begging me to give him something to do."
"Should I go see him?"
"He's not on his deathbed, if that's what you're implying. But you should pay a visit sometime soon. Who knows? You might actually decide that you like your country again."
"I love my country, Uzi."
"Just not enough to live there."
"You always did remind me a bit of Shamron," Gabriel said with a frown. "But now the resemblance is uncanny."
"Gila told me the same thing not long ago."
"I didn't mean it as a compliment."
"Neither did she."
Navot added another spoonful of clotted cream to his scone with exaggerated care. "So why are you here, Uzi?"
"I want to present you with a unique opportunity."
"You sound like a salesman."
"I'm a spy," Navot said. "There's not much of a difference."
"What are you offering?"
"A chance to atone for a mistake."
"What mistake was that?"
"You should have shot Farid Khan through the back of the head before he hit his detonator switch."
Navot lowered his voice and added confidingly,
"That's what I would have done if I'd been in your shoes."
"And how might I make amends for this lapse in judgment?"
"By accepting an invitation."
"From whom?" Navot gazed silently westward.
"The Americans?"
asked Gabriel. Navot smiled.
"More tea?"
The rain ceased as abruptly as it began. Gabriel left money on the table and led Navot down the steep footpath to Polpio Cove. The bodyguard was still leaning against the crumbled lifeboat ramp. He watched with feigned indifference as Gabriel and Navot made their way slowly across the rocky beach to the water's edge. Navot cast a distracted glance at his stainless steel wristwatch and turned up his coat collar against the gusty wind rising from the sea. Gabriel was once again struck by the uncanny resemblance to Shamron. The likeness went beyond the superficial. It was as if Shamron, by the sheer force of his indomitable will, had somehow managed to take possession of Navot, body and soul. It was not the Shamron who had been weakened by age and infirmity, thought Gabriel, but Shamron in his prime. All that was missing were the wretched Turkish cigarettes that had ravaged Shamron's health. Bella had never permitted Navot to smoke, not even for the sake of his cover. "Who's behind the bombings, Uzi?"
"Thus far, we've been unable to make a firm attribution. The Americans, however, seem to think he's the future face of global jihadist terror. The new Bin Laden."
"Does this new Bin Laden have a name?"
"The Americans insist on sharing that information with you face to face. They'd like you to come to Washington, all expenses paid, of course."
"How was this invitation extended?"
"Adrian Carter called me personally."
Adrian Carter was the director of the CIA's National Clandestine Service.
"What's the dress code?"
"Black," said Navot. "Your visit to America will be entirely off the books."
Gabriel regarded Navot in silence for a moment. "You obviously want me to go, Uzi. You wouldn't be here otherwise."
"It couldn't hurt," Navot said.
"At the very least, it will give us an opportunity to hear what the Americans have to say about the bombings.
But there are other fringe benefits as well."
"Such as?"
"Our relationship could use a bit of retouching."
"What sort of retouching?"
"Haven't you heard? There's a new wind blowing through Washington. "Changes in the air," Navot added sarcastically. "The new American president is an idealist. He believes he can repair relationships between the West and Islam, and he's convinced himself that we're part of the problem."
"So the solution is to send me, a former assassin, with the blood of several Palestinian and Islamic terrorists on his hands?"
"When spies play nicely together, it tends to spill over into the political realm, which is why the Prime Minister is eager for you to make the trip as well."
"The Prime Minister? The next thing you're going to tell me is that Shamron is involved, too."
"He is."
Nawad picked up a stone and hurled it into the sea.
"After the Iran op, I allowed myself to think Shamron might finally fade gracefully into the background. I was wrong. He has no intention of allowing me to run the office without his constant interference.
But that's not surprising, is it, Gabriel?
We both know Shamron had someone else in mind for the job. I'm fated to go down in the history of our illustrious service as the accidental chief. And you'll always be the chosen one."
"Choose someone else, Uzi. I'm retired, remember? Send someone else to Washington."
"Adrian won't hear of it," Nawad said, rubbing his shoulder, "and neither will Shamron. As for your so-called retirement, it ended the moment you decided to follow Farid Khan into Covent Garden."
Gabriel stared out at the sea and pictured the aftermath of the shot not taken. Body parts and blood. Baghdad on the Thames. Nawad seemed to sense what he was thinking. He pressed his advantage.
"The Americans would like you in Washington first thing in the morning. There's a Gulf Stream waiting for you outside London. It was one of the planes they used for the rendition program. They've assured me the handcuffs and hypodermic needles have been removed."
"What about Chiara?"
"The invitation is for one. She can't stay here alone. Graham has agreed to send a security team from London."
"I don't trust them, Uzi. Take her back to Israel with you. She can help Gila look after the old man for a few days until I get back."
"She might be there a while."
Gabriel looked at Navot carefully. He clearly knew more than he was saying. He usually did.
"I just agreed to restore a picture for Julian Isherwood. A Madonna and Child with Mary Magdalene, formerly attributed to the studio of Palma Vecchio, now tentatively attributed to Titian, pending peer review."
"Very impressive, Uzi.
Bella's been trying to broaden my horizons."
"The painting can't stay in an empty cottage by the sea."
"Julian's agreed to take it back. As you might expect, he's rather disappointed. I was supposed to be paid £200,000 for that piece." "Don't look at me, Gabriel. The cupboard is bare. I've been forced to institute across-the-board cuts in every department. The accountants are even after me to reduce my personal expenses. My per diem is a pittance."
"Good thing you're on a diet." Navot absently touched his midsection as if checking to see whether it had expanded since leaving home. "It's a long drive back to London, Uzi. Maybe you should take along some of those scones."
"Don't even think about it."
"You're afraid Bella will find out?"
"I know she will."
Navot glared at the bodyguard leaning against the lifeboat ramp.
"Those bastards tell her everything. It's like living in a police state."
11. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. The house stood in the 3300 block of N Street, one of an elegant terrace of federal-style residences priced far beyond the reach of all but the wealthiest of Washingtonians. Gabriel climbed the curved front steps in the grey half-light of dawn and, as instructed, entered without ringing the bell. Adrian Carter waited in the foyer, dressed in wrinkled chinos, a crew-neck sweater, and a tan corduroy blazer. The attire, combined with his tousled, thinning hair and unfashionable moustache, gave him the air of a professor from a minor university, the sort who championed noble causes and was a constant thorn in the side of his dean. As director of the CIA's National Clandestine Service, Carter had no cause these days other than keeping the American homeland safe from another terrorist attack. Though twice each month, schedule permitting, he could be found in the basement of his Episcopal church in suburban Reston, preparing meals for the homeless.
For Carter, the volunteer work was a meditation, a rare opportunity to thrust his hands into something other than the internecine warfare that raged constantly in the conference rooms of America's sprawling intelligence community. He greeted Gabriel with a circumspection that comes naturally to men of the clandestine world and ushered him inside. Gabriel paused for a moment in the center hallway and looked around. Secret protocols had been made and broken in these drably furnished rooms. Men had been seduced into betraying their countries for suitcases filled with American money and promises of American protection. Carter had used the property so often it was known throughout Langley as his Georgetown pied-à-terre. One agency wit had christened it the Dar al-Harb, Arabic for the House of War. It was covert war, of course, for Carter knew no other way to fight. Adrian Carter had not actively sought power. It had been foisted upon his narrow shoulders block by unwanted block. Recruited by the agency while still an undergraduate, he had spent most of his career waging secret war against the Russians, first in Poland, where he funneled money and mimeograph machines to Solidarity, then in Moscow, where he served as station chief, and finally in Afghanistan, where he encouraged and armed the soldiers of Allah, even though he knew that one day they would rain fire and death upon him. If Afghanistan would prove to be the evil empire's undoing, it would provide Carter with a ticket to career advancement. He monitored the collapse of the Soviet Union not from the field, but from a comfortable office at Langley, where he had recently been promoted to chief of the European Division. While his subordinates openly cheered the demise of their enemy, Carter watched the events unfold with a sense of foreboding. His beloved agency had failed to predict communism's collapse, a blunder that would haunt Langley for years. Worse still, in the blink of an eye, the CIA had lost its very reason for existence. That changed on the morning of September the 11th, 2001. The war that would follow would be a war fought in the shadows, a place Adrian Carter knew well. While the Pentagon had struggled to come up with a military response to the horror of 9/11, it was Carter and his staff at the Counterterrorism Center who produced a bold plan to destroy Al-Qaeda's Afghan sanctuary with a CIA-funded guerrilla war guided by a small force of American special operatives. And when the commanders and foot soldiers of Al-Qaeda began falling into American hands, it was Carter, from his desk at Langley, who often served as their judge and jury. The black sites, the extraordinary renditions, the enhanced interrogation methods, they all bore Carter's fingerprints. He felt no remorse over his actions. He hadn't that luxury. For Adrian Carter, every morning was September 12th. Never again, he vowed, would he watch Americans hurling themselves from burning skyscrapers because they could no longer bear the heat of a terrorist fire. For 10 years, Carter had managed to keep that promise. No one had done more to protect the American homeland from the much-anticipated second attack, and for his many secret sins he had been pilloried in the press and threatened with criminal prosecution. On the advice of agency lawyers, he had retained the services of a high-priced Washington attorney, an extravagance that had steadily drained his savings and forced his wife Margaret to return to teaching. Friends had urged Carter to forsake the agency and take a lucrative position in Washington's flourishing private security industry, but he refused. His failure to prevent the attacks of 9/11 haunted him still, and the ghosts of the 3,000 compelled him to keep fighting until his enemy was vanquished. The war had taken its toll on Carter, not only on his family life, which was a shambles, but on his health as well. His face was gaunt and drawn, and Gabriel noticed a slight tremor in Carter's right hand as he joylessly filled a plate with the government-issued treats arrayed atop the sideboard in the dining room. "High blood pressure," Carter explained, as he drew coffee from a pump-action thermos. "It started on Inauguration Day, and it rises and falls in relation to the terrorist threat level. It's sad to say, but after 10 years of fighting Islamic terror, I seem to have become a living, breathing national threat advisory." "What level are we today?" "Didn't you hear?" asked Carter. "We've abandoned the old color-coded system. What's your blood pressure telling you?" "Red," said Carter dourly. "Bright red." "Not according to your Director of Homeland Security.
She says there's no immediate threat.
She doesn't always write her own lines.
Who does?
The White House, said Carter.
And the President doesn't like to needlessly alarm the American people. Besides, raising the threat level would conflict with the convenient narrative making its way around the Washington chattering classes these days.
Which narrative is that?
The one that says America overreacted to 9/11.
The one that says Al-Qaeda is no longer a threat to anyone, let alone the most powerful nation on the face of the earth.
The one that says it's time to declare victory in the global war on terror and turn our attention inward.
Carter frowned.
God, but I hated when journalists used the word narrative.
There was a time when novelists wrote narrative and journalists were content to report facts. And the facts are quite simple.
There exists in the world today an organized force that seeks to weaken or even destroy the West through acts of indiscriminate violence. This force is a part of a broader radical movement to impose Sharia law and restore the Islamic Caliphate. And no amount of wishful thinking will make it go away.
They sat on opposite sides of the rectangular table. Carter picked at the edge of a stale croissant, his thoughts clearly elsewhere. Gabriel knew better than to rush the proceedings. In conversation, Carter could be a bit of a wanderer. Eventually he would make his way to the point, but there would be several detours and digressions along the way, all of which would undoubtedly prove useful to Gabriel at a later date.
"In some respects," Carter continued, "I'm sympathetic to the President's desire to turn the page of history. He views the global war on terrorism as a distraction from his larger goals. You might find this difficult to believe, but I've seen him on just two occasions. He calls me Andrew. But at least he's given us hope. Hope is not an acceptable strategy when lives are at stake. Hope is what led to 9/11.
So who's pulling the strings inside the administration?
James McKenna, assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, also known as the Terrorism Czar, which is interesting since he's issued an edict banning the word terrorism from all our public pronouncements. He even discourages its use behind closed doors, and heaven forbid if we happen to place the word Islamic anywhere near it. As far as James McKenna is concerned, we aren't engaged in a war against Islamic terrorists. We're engaged in an international effort against a small band of transnational extremists. These extremists, who just happen to be Muslims, are an irritant, but pose no real threat to our existence or way of life.
Tell that to the families of those who died in Paris, Copenhagen, and London.
That's an emotional response, Carter said sardonically, and James McKenna doesn't tolerate emotion when it comes to talking about terrorism.
You mean extremism, said Gabriel.
Forgive me, Carter said.
McKenna is a political animal who fancies himself an expert on intelligence. He worked on the staff of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee in the 90s, and came to Langley shortly after the Greek arrived. He lasted only a few months, but that doesn't stop him from describing himself as a veteran of the CIA. To hear McKenna tell it, he's an agency man who has the best interests of the agency at heart. The truth is somewhat different. He loathes the agency and all those who toil within its walls. Most of all, he despises me.
Why?
Apparently I embarrassed him during a senior staff meeting. I don't remember the incident, but it seems McKenna has never gotten over it. Beyond that, I'm told McKenna regards me as a monster who's done irreparable harm to America's image in the world. Nothing would make him happier than to see me behind bars.
It's good to know the U.S. intelligence community is functioning smoothly again.
Actually, McKenna is under the impression it's working just fine now that he's running the entire show. He even managed to get himself appointed chairman of our new high-value detainee interrogation group. If a major terrorist figure is captured anywhere in the world under any circumstances, James McKenna will be in charge of questioning him.
It's a great deal of power to place in the hands of a single person, even if that person were competent. But, unfortunately, James McKenna doesn't fall into that category. He's ambitious, he's well-intentioned, but he doesn't know what he's doing. And if he isn't careful, he's going to get us all killed.
Sounds charming, said Gabriel. When do I get to meet him?
Never.
So why am I here, Adrian?
You're here because of Paris, Copenhagen, and London.
Who carried it out?
A new branch of Al-Qaeda, said Carter. But I'm afraid they had support from a person who occupies a sensitive and powerful position in Western intelligence.
Who?
Carter said nothing more. His right hand was shaking.
12. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. They adjourned to the rear terrace and settled into a pair of wrought-iron chairs along the balustrade. Carter balanced a coffee cup on his knee and gazed toward the gray spires rising gracefully above Georgetown University. Paradoxically, he was speaking of a shabby district of San Diego, where, on a summer day in 1999, there arrived a young Yemeni cleric named Rashid al-Husseini. With money provided by a Saudi-based Islamic charity, the Yemeni purchased a run-down commercial property, established a mosque, and went in search of a congregation. He did most of his hunting on the campus of San Diego State University, where he acquired a devoted following among Arab students who had come to America to escape the stifling social oppression of their homelands, only to find themselves lost and adrift in the Ghurba, the land of strangers. Rashid was uniquely qualified to serve as their guide. The only son of a former Yemeni government minister, he had been born in America, spoke colloquial American English, and was the not-so-proud owner of an American passport.
All sorts of strays and lost souls began stumbling into Rashid's mosque, including a pair of Saudis named Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi.
Carter glanced at Gabriel and added, "I trust you're familiar with the names."
They were two of the muscle hijackers from American Flight 77, personally selected by none other than Osama bin Laden himself. In January 2000, they were present at the planning meeting in Kuala Lumpur, after which the bin Laden unit of the CIA managed to lose track of them. Later it was discovered that both had flown to Los Angeles and were probably still in the United States. A fact you neglected to tell the FBI.
"Much to my everlasting shame," said Carter. "But this isn't a story about al-Midar and al-Hazmi."
"It was a story," Carter resumed, "about Rashid al-Husseini, who soon developed a reputation in the Islamic world as a magnetic preacher, a man to whom Allah had granted a beautiful and seductive tongue. His sermons became required listening, not only in San Diego, but also in the Middle East, where they were distributed by audio tape. In the spring of 2001, he was offered a clerical position at an influential Islamic center outside Washington, in suburban Falls Church, Virginia. Before long, Nawaf al-Hazmi was praying there, along with a young Saudi from Taif named Hani Hanjour."
"Coincidentally," said Carter, "the mosque is located on Leesburg Pike. If you hang a left onto Columbia Pike and go a couple of miles, you run smack into the western facade of the Pentagon, which is exactly what Hani Hanjour did on the morning of 9/11. Rashid was in his office at the time. He actually heard the plane pass overhead a few seconds before impact."
It did not take long for the FBI to connect al-Hazmi and Hanjour to the Falls Church Mosque, said Carter, or for the news media to beat a path to Rashid's door. What they discovered was an eloquent and enlightened young cleric, a man of moderation who condemned the attacks of 9/11 without equivocation and urged his Muslim brethren to forsake violence and terrorism in all its forms. The White House was so impressed with the charismatic imam that he was invited to join several other Muslim scholars and clerics for a private meeting with the president. The State Department thought Rashid might be the perfect sort of figure to help build a bridge between America and 1.5 billion skeptical Muslims. The agency, however, had another idea.
"We thought Rashid could help us to penetrate the camp of our new enemy," said Carter. "But before we made our approach,
He had to answer a few questions. Namely, was he somehow involved in the 9/11 plot, or were his contacts with the three hijackers purely coincidental? We looked at him from every conceivable angle, starting with the assumption that he had a great deal of American blood on his hands. We looked at timetables. We looked at who was where and when. And at the end of the process, we concluded that Imam Rashid al-Husseini was clean. And then, we dispatched an emissary to Falls Church to see whether Rashid might be willing to put his words into action. His response was positive. We picked him up the next day and took him to a secure location near the Pennsylvania border. And then the real fun began. You started the assessment process all over again. Carter nodded. But this time we had the subject seated before us, strapped to a polygraph. We questioned him for 3 days, pulling apart his past and his associations piece by piece. And his story held up. He passed with flying colors. So we placed our proposition on the table, accompanied by a great deal of money. It was a simple operation. Rashid would tour the Islamic world, preaching tolerance and moderation, while at the same time supplying us with the names of other potential recruits to our cause. In addition, he was to be on the lookout for angry young men who appeared vulnerable to the siren song of the jihadis. We took him on a domestic test drive, working closely with the FBI. And then we went international. Operating from a base in a predominantly Muslim neighborhood in East London, Rashid spent the next 3 years crisscrossing Europe and the Middle East. He spoke at conferences, preached in mosques, and sat for interviews with fawning journalists. He denounced bin Laden as a murderer who had violated the laws of Allah and the teachings of the Prophet. He recognized the right of Israel to exist and called for a negotiated peace with the Palestinians. He condemned Saddam Hussein as thoroughly un-Islamic, though, on the advice of his CIA handlers, he stopped short of endorsing the American invasion. His message did not always go over well with his audiences, nor were his activities confined to the physical world. With CIA assistance, Rashid built a presence on the Internet, where he attempted to compete with the jihadist propaganda of Al-Qaeda. Visitors to the site were identified and tracked as they moved through cyberspace.
The operation was regarded as one of our most successful efforts to penetrate a world that, for the most part, we had found almost entirely opaque. Rashid fed his handlers a steady stream of names, good guys, and potential bad guys, and even tipped them off about some plots that were brewing. At Langley, we spent a great deal of time marveling at our cleverness. We thought it would go on forever. But it all ended rather suddenly.
The setting, fittingly enough, was Mecca. Rashid had been invited to speak at the university, a high honor for a cleric who had been cursed with an American passport. Given the fact that Mecca is closed to infidels, the CIA had no choice but to allow him to go alone. He flew from Amman to Riyadh, where he met a final time with one of his CIA handlers, then boarded an internal Saudi Airlines flight to Mecca. His speech was scheduled for 8 that evening. Rashid never showed up. He had vanished without a trace.
At first, we feared he'd been kidnapped and killed by a local branch of Al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be the case. Our prized possession resurfaced on the Internet a few weeks later. The eloquent, enlightened young man of moderation was gone. He'd been replaced by a raving fanatic who preached that the only way to deal with the West was to destroy it.
He deceived you.
Obviously.
For how long?
That remains an open question, said Carter. There are some at Langley who believe Rashid was bad from the beginning. Others who theorize he was driven over the edge by the guilt of working as a spy for the infidels. Whatever the case, one thing is beyond dispute. During the time he was traveling the Islamic world on my dime, he recruited an impressive network of operatives right under our noses. He's the ultimate talent spotter and skilled in the art of deception and misdirection. We hoped he would stick to preaching and recruiting, but that hope turned out to be misplaced. The attacks in Europe were Rashid's coming-out party.
He wants to replace Osama bin Laden as leader of the global jihadist movement. He also wants to do something bin Laden was never able to accomplish after 9/11.
"Strike the far enemy in his homeland," said Gabriel. "Shed American blood on American soil."
"With a network bought and paid for by the Central Intelligence Agency," Carter added soberly. "How would you like that, chiseled on your headstone? If it were ever made public that Rashid al-Husseini was once on our payroll..." Carter's voice trailed off. "Ashes, ashes, we all fall down." "What do you want from me, Adrian?"
"I want you to make the bombing in Covent Garden the last attack Rashid al-Husseini ever carries out. I want you to smash his network before anyone else dies because of my folly."
"Is that all?"
"No," said Carter. "I want you to keep the entire operation secret from the President, James McKenna, and the rest of the American intelligence community."
13. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Adrian Carter was doctrinaire when it came to matters of tradecraft, which meant he could not talk for too long within the confines of a safe house, even if it was one of his own. They descended the curved front steps and, with a single CIA security man in tow, headed westward along N Street. It was a few minutes after 9 o'clock. Carter's penny loafers tapped rhythmically on the red brick sidewalk, but Gabriel seemed to move without a sound. A metro bus rumbled past, filled to capacity. Gabriel pictured the same bus, torn in half, and engulfed in flames.
Where did he go after leaving Mecca?
We believe he's living under the protection of tribal elements in the Rafhad Valley of Yemen. It's a completely lawless place without schools, paved roads, or even a reliable supply of water. In fact, the entire country is dry as a bone. Sana'a might be the first capital city on earth to actually run out of water.
But not Islamic militants, said Gabriel.
Oh, no, Carter agreed. Yemen is well on its way to becoming the next Afghanistan. For now, we've been content to lob the occasional hellfire missile over the border. But it's only a matter of time before we have to put boots on the ground and drain the swamp. He glanced at Gabriel and added, There actually are swamps in Yemen, by the way. A string of marshes along the coastline that produce malarial mosquitoes the size of buzzards. My God, what a dreadful place.
Carter walked in silence for a moment with his hands clasped behind his back and his head down. Gabriel deftly sidestepped a tree root that had risen through the sidewalk and asked how Rashid managed to communicate with his network from so remote a place.
We haven't been able to figure that out, Carter replied. We assume he's using local tribesmen to ferry messages to Sana'a, or perhaps across the Gulf of Aden to Somalia, where he's forged a relationship with the Al-Shabaab terror group. We're certain of one thing, though. Rashid spends no time on the phone, satellite or otherwise. He learned a great deal about American capabilities when he was on our payroll. And now that he's gone over to the other side, he's put that knowledge to good use. I don't suppose you also taught him how to plan and execute a synchronized series of attacks in 3 European countries.
Rashid is a talent spotter and a source of inspiration, said Carter. But he's no operational mastermind. He's clearly working with someone good. If I had to guess, the 3 attacks in Europe were carried out by someone who cut his teeth in Baghdad. Gabriel said, finishing Carter's thought for him.
The MIT of terrorism, Carter added, nodding in agreement. Its graduates are all PhDs, and they serve their internships by matching wits with the agency and the American military.
All the more reason why you should deal with them.
Carter made no reply.
Why us, Adrian?
Because the American counterterrorism apparatus has grown so large, we can't seem to get out of our own way. At last count, we had more than 800,000 people with top-secret clearances. 800,000, Carter repeated incredulously. And yet we still weren't able to prevent a single Islamic militant from planting a bomb in the heart of Times Square. Our ability to collect information is unrivaled, but we're too big,
and far too redundant to be effective. We are Americans, after all, and when confronted with a threat, we throw large amounts of money at it. Sometimes it's better to be small and ruthless, like you. We warned you about the perils of reorganizing, and we would have been wise to listen, said Carter. But our unwieldy size is only part of the problem. After 9/11, the gloves came off, and we adopted a whatever-it-takes attitude when it came to dealing with the enemy. These days we try not to mention the enemy by name, lest we offend him. At Langley, counter-terrorism jobs are considered politically risky. All the best officers in the clandestine service are learning to speak Mandarin. The Chinese aren't actively plotting to kill Americans. But Rashid is, Carter said. And our intelligence suggests he's planning something spectacular in the very near future. We need to break his network, and we need to do it quickly. But we can't do that if we're forced to operate under the new rules put in place by President Hope and his well-intentioned accomplice, James McKenna. So you want us to do your dirty work for you? I'd do the same for you, Carter said. And don't try to tell me that you lack the capability. The office was the first Western-oriented intelligence service to establish an analytical unit dedicated to the global jihadist movement. You were also first to identify Osama bin Laden as a major terrorist, and the first to have a go at killing him. If you'd succeeded, it's highly likely that 9/11 would never have happened. They arrived at the corner of 35th Street. The next block was closed to traffic by a barricade. On the opposite side, children from the Holy Trinity School skipped rope and tossed balls in the street, their joyous screams reverberating off the facades of the surrounding buildings. It was an idyllic scene, full of charm and life. But it made Carter visibly uneasy. "Homeland security is a myth," he said, gazing at the children. "It's a bedtime story we tell our people to make them feel safe at night. Despite all our best efforts and all our billions spent, the United States is largely indefensible. The only way to prevent attacks on American soil is to snuff them out before they reach our shores. We have to rip apart their networks and kill their operatives. Killing Rashid al-Husseini might not be a bad idea either." "We'd love to," said Carter, "but that won't be possible until we can find some way into his inner circle." Carter led Gabriel northward along 35th Street. He removed his pipe from the pocket of his coat and began absently loading the bowl with tobacco. "You've been fighting the terrorists longer than anyone else in the business, Gabriel. Anyone but Shamron, of course. You know how to penetrate their networks, something we've never been very good at, and you know how to turn them inside out. I want you to get inside Rashid's network and destroy it. I want you to make it go away." "Penetrating jihadist terror networks isn't the same as penetrating the PLO. They're far too clannish to accept outsiders into their midst, and their members are largely immune to earthly temptations. A rose is a rose is a rose, and a network is a network is a network." "Meaning?" "I'll grant you there are differences between jihadist and Palestinian terror networks, but the basic structure is the same. There are planners and foot soldiers, paymasters and quartermasters, couriers and safe houses, and at the points where all these pieces intersect, there is vulnerability just waiting to be exploited by someone as clever as you." A breath of wind carried the pipe smoke into Gabriel's face. Blended exclusively for Carter by a tobacconist in New York, it smelled of burning leaves and wet dog. Gabriel waved it away and asked, "How would it work?"
"Does that mean you'll do it?"
"No," said Gabriel. "It means I want to know exactly how it would work." "You would operate as a virtual station of the counterterrorism center in much the same way the bin Laden unit functioned before 9/11. But with one important difference. The rest of the CTC won't know I'm there." Carter nodded. "All document requests will be handled by my staff and me. And when it's time for you to go operational, I'll act as a clandestine traffic cop,
to make sure you don't trip over any ongoing agency operations, and they don't trip over you. I would need to see everything you have. Everything, Adrian. You'll be given access to the most sensitive intelligence available to the government of the United States, including the case files on Rashid and all the NSA intercepts. You'll also be allowed to see all the intelligence on the three attacks that's flowing to us from our sister services in Europe. Carter paused. I would think that information alone would be tempting enough for you to accept the assignment. After all, your liaison relationships with the Europeans aren't terribly good at the moment. Gabriel didn't respond directly. It's too much material to review on my own. I'd need help. You can import as much help as you want, within reason. Given the sensitive nature of the intelligence, I'll also need someone from the agency looking over your shoulder, someone who knows your mischievous ways. I have a candidate in mind. Where is she? Waiting in a cafe on Wisconsin Avenue. You're very sure of yourself, Adrian. Carter stopped walking and checked his pipe. Were I to stoop to raw sentimentality, he said after a moment, I would remind you of the carnage you witnessed last Friday afternoon in Covent Garden, and ask you to imagine it played out over and over again. But I won't do that, because it would be unprofessional. Instead, I will tell you that Rashid has an army of martyrs just like Farid Khan waiting to do his bidding, an army he recruited with my help. I made Rashid. He's my mistake, and I need you to destroy him before anyone else has to die. You might find this difficult to believe, but I actually don't have the authority to say yes to you. Uzi would have to sign off on it first. He already has. So has your Prime Minister. I suppose you've also had a quiet word with Graham Seymour. Carter nodded. For obvious reasons, Graham would like to be kept abreast of your progress. He would also like advance warning if your operation happens to wash ashore in the British Isles. You misled me, Adrian. I'm a spy, Carter said, relighting his pipe. I lie as a matter of course. So do you. Now you just have to figure out a way to lie to Rashid. Just be careful how you go about it. He's very good, our Rashid. I have the scars to prove it.
14. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. The cafe was located at the northern end of Georgetown, at the foot of Book Hill Park. Gabriel ordered a cappuccino from the bar and carried it through a pair of open French doors into a small garden with vine-covered walls. Three of the tables were in shadow, the fourth in brilliant sunlight. A woman sat there alone reading a newspaper. She wore a black running suit that clung tightly to her slender frame and a pair of spotless white training shoes. Her shoulder-length blonde hair was brushed straight back from her forehead and held in place by an elastic band at the nape of her neck. Sunglasses concealed her eyes, but not her remarkable beauty. She removed the glasses as Gabriel approached and tilted her face to be kissed. She seemed surprised to see him.
I was hoping it would be you, said Sarah Bancroft.
Adrian didn't tell you I was coming?
He's much too old-fashioned for that, she said with a dismissive wave of her hand. She had a voice and manner of speech from another age. It was like listening to a character from a Fitzgerald novel. He dropped me a secure email last night and told me to be here at 9. I was to stay until 10:30. If no one appeared, I was to leave and to go to work as normal. It's a good thing you came. You know how much I hate being stood up.
I see you brought reading material, Gabriel said, glancing at the newspaper.
You disapprove?
Office doctrine forbids agents to read newspapers in cafes. It's far too obvious, he paused, then added, I thought we trained you better than that, Sarah.
You did, but on occasion I like to behave like a normal person, and a normal person sometimes finds it pleasurable to read a newspaper in a cafe on a sunny autumn morning. with a Glock concealed at the small of her back. Thanks to you, it's my constant companion."
Sarah gave a melancholy smile. The daughter of a wealthy Citibank executive, she had spent much of her childhood in Europe, where she had acquired a continental education, along with continental languages and impeccable continental manners. She had returned to America to attend Dartmouth, and later, after spending a year at the prestigious Courtauld Institute of Art in London, she became the youngest woman ever to earn a PhD in art history at Harvard. But it was Sarah Bancroft's love life, not her sterling education, that led her into the world of intelligence. While finishing her dissertation, she began dating a young lawyer named Ben Callahan, who had the misfortune of boarding United Airlines Flight 175 on the morning of September 11, 2001. He managed to make one telephone call before the plane plunged into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. That call was to Sarah. With Adrian Carter's blessing, and with the help of a lost Van Gogh, Gabriel inserted her into the entourage of a Saudi billionaire named Zizi Al-Bakari, in a daring bid to find the terrorist mastermind lurking within it. At the conclusion of the operation, she had joined the CIA and was assigned to the Counterterrorism Center. Since then, she had maintained close contact with the office and had worked with Gabriel and his team on numerous occasions. She had even taken an office lover, an assassin and field operative named Mikhail Abramov. Judging by the absence of a ring on her finger, the relationship was proceeding at a slower pace than she had hoped. "We've been on again, off again for a while," she said, as if reading Gabriel's thoughts.
"And at the moment?"
"Off," she said. "Definitely off."
"I told you not to become involved with a man who kills for his country."
"You were right, Gabriel. You're always right."
"So what happened?"
"I'd rather not go into all the sordid details."
"He told me he was in love with you."
"He told me the same thing. Funny how that works."
"Did he hurt you?"
"I don't think I'm capable of being hurt any longer."
It took a moment for Sarah to smile. She wasn't being honest. Gabriel could see that.
"Do you want me to have a word with him?"
"Heavens, no," she said. "I'm more than capable of screwing up my life completely on my own."
"He's been through a couple of difficult operations, Sarah. The last one was..."
"He told me all about it," she said. "I sometimes wish he hadn't come out of the Alps alive."
"You don't mean that?"
"No,"
she said grudgingly.
"But it felt good to say it."